Hi, this is Paul. Yesterday, the Christian Reformed Church released its statement on Israel-Palestinian conflict. And I always feel unease about this sort of thing that, okay, partly it's just the way the Christian Reformed Church is organized in that we don't have a pope, but I don't really think the Christian Reformed Church is quite clear on its identity and who it wants to be. It'll almost always point to synodical decisions, and on the basis of synodical decisions, we're going to make these statements. This past weekend, many of us were shocked and horrified to hear that the unexpected attack that happened in South Israel, the militant terrorist group known as Hamas, launched an unprecedented attack on Israeli communities near Gaza. They killed hundreds of residents and took dozens of hostages soon after the Israeli military responded with defensive action inside Israel and in Gaza, which resulted in more loss of life. So churches sort of respond to these things. And again, if in some ways you have a pope, the pope and the hierarchy sort of are the church, and they are an entity and they speak. The conceptualization of the Christian Reformed Church in terms of what the church is, the Christian Reformed Church very much tries to sort of balance local instantiation, which is the congregation, and then the classis, which is in the middle, and then the synod, which is on top. And then, of course, there's this cyborg, which is you have an executive secretary. And so it's always a little bit weird, and this on CRC Voices always has a little bit and then it links to a, for those who wish to learn more about the situation, actions that North Americans can take, urge to read the statement from Churches for Middle East Peace. And on CRC Voices, this was considerably less well received. And so right away, there's sides and there's side taking on this. And there's this sense of, and this is what's so interesting to me, there's this sense of moral obligation to take a side. Now, for me, part of this is deeply tied to this history of Protestant confessionalism, and my sense of growing up in a church where so much of this, the arena was this identity and a propositional landmark. So propositional landscape, propositional arena where, okay, we there's this enormous urge to have the right position and the right stance on something. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that I'm in no way denying the reality and the physicality of what happened on the ground a few days ago in Gaza and along the Israeli border and the communities there. But to me, it all sort of takes place on screens. And the arena in which we are operating is very much both imaginative. It's these principalities working in a non-physical space or a spiritual space that is sort of controlling the meat space and we as creatures moving around. And so then this thing that is the Christian Reformed Church feels the need to make a statement. And on one hand, this is leadership. Well, we want to help our people know how to pray. But what's amazing is that the spiritual formation of people who both sort of instinctively either say, I stand with Israel, or I stand with the Palestinians, that spiritual formation long precedes the influence of the church. And in fact, it tends to be sort of in democratic terms, the membership of the Christian Reformed Church exerting its influence onto the church, and the church sort of becomes this horcrux. Now, for those of you who, I was never a big Harry Potter fan, I haven't read the books, I've only watched the movies, I've watched the movies a number of times because my kids were of that age, my kids read the books, I didn't read the books, but I was fascinated by this idea of a horcrux by which Voldemort sort of loses his physical instantiation, and then continues to sort of get it more and more as the story develops. He gets more and more real. And to me, J.K. Rowling sort of took a page from Tolkien in that, because Sauron, of course, the Horcrux for Sauron is really the ring. And so, yeah, there are portions in the movie, for example, when the, you know, Gandalf and others are basically saying, well, Sauron hasn't been able to take physical form. He's sort of spiritual form, and that's the way that Sauron is represented in the movies. But he's instantiated in the ring, so therefore, as with these Horcruxes, as with these sort of, they're not really sacraments, because sacraments, like icons, are portaled through to the more substantive spiritual reality, the foundational spiritual reality. It's sort of a physicalist interpretation where the spiritual is nailed down into the physical. So if you destroy the ring, then Sauron goes. If you destroy the Horcruxes, then, or is it Horcrux? Is that plural? I don't know. If you destroy them, then Voldemort is defeated. And so what you see is this inversion from the spiritual as primary to the physical as secondary, towards the physical as primary and the spiritual as dependent and determinant. And so what you tend to see in the Christian Reformed Church is this sort of democratic embodiment that gets expressed in this institution. And then Zachary King, the general secretary of the institution, has to write, perhaps with the aid of writers that the denomination has, or maybe Zach wrote this himself, I don't know, then has to sort of instantiate this. But then this then becomes more fodder for the spiritual conflict within the Christian Reformed Church that in some ways is a proxy conflict from the rest of the culture. On CRC Voices, I posted this. Ryan Long has a real gift for sort of putting his finger on things. And so here, Ryan Long plays an actor, which I like. So he plays an actor. And this actor, because he's an actor and because actors are sort of functional stars in our imaginary, he plays an actor, and the actor now has to take a stand either with Israel or Palestine, and he doesn't know what to do because all of his sense-making apparatus, and this is what's, you know, part of what's incredible about this particular conflict, all of his sense-making apparatus is sort of confused by all the cross pressures in this conflict. And he so nicely just rattles them off really quickly in this.
It's been a few days now. I still haven't weighed in on Israel-Palestine. I honestly don't know who to post.
Okay, first of all, he doesn't know who to post. And that's key. Because he, in a sense, the postings, we're going to get into pro-felicity here, that becomes the Horcrux. That becomes the arena in which his identity is instantiated. So I honestly don't know who to post.
Usually it's easy. BLM, bang, Ukraine, bang.
Usually it's easy. BLM, Ukraine. So he sort of has a sense of where the spirits are going in terms of the right side of the duality, because again, consciousness is very monofocal. Or awareness is monofocal, attention is monofocal, and monofocality creates binaries, yes or no, and threes then become really interesting. But, you know, so usually he just follows the ascendant narrative in the society, so BLM.
COVID, bang. Hey, did you do your Israel-Palestine post yet? I've never missed a stance. So who'd you?
I love that. I've never missed a stance, because he's living in this arena of the Horcrux of our social media.
Go with. I look at my phone, I see a lot of Republicans supporting Israel, so I go.
I look at my phone, I see a lot of Republicans supporting Israel, so.
Well, maybe stay away from that.
So maybe stay away from that, because of course, now he's in an urban environment. He's got to be blue state, so he's got to be there. But white supremacist leaders applaud Hamas and violence against Israel. But, you know, so in other words, Republicans bad. And of course, this is inverted in other places.
And I see a lot of the people we've been calling Nazis supporting Palestine.
Then I see a lot of the people we've been calling Nazis supporting Palestine. Well, why? Because they're anti-Semitic. And that's what's so incredible about this issue, because all of the normal seats in the arena that we sort of look to for our tribes, they get scrambled because, well, Nazis would stand with Hamas. But all of these people that have been slinging the Nazi label at others are sounding absolutely anti-Semitic.
But then get this, the people that we've been calling them Nazis with are happy Israel's getting attacked.
Say them right there.
Tell me that. But there really is no easy answer here. Did you do your Israel-Palestine post yet?
No.
What does your manager think of that?
I'm retired.
I love that. What does your manager think of that? Well, because we all have managers. Well, we all have these gods. We all have these arenas that we're doing these things in. So, you know, I think, and you can watch the rest of it. I think it's, he so nails where this is at. And so now Elon Musk on Twitter posts this great clip from Comedy Central of Jon Stewart with this sketch basically of 9 years ago, another Hamas-Israel conflict. And basically the point of this sketch was this issue scrambles sort of the normal polarity, and Jon Stewart basically makes the same point as Ryan Long, because each way he goes, he's wrong, and so he decides to not say anything about it. Ben Sixsmith sort of nails this one when he says, I have a lot of respect for people who stay focused on their niche interest while the TL is dominated, the timeline is dominated by current events. 95% of posts are about Israel and Gaza, and there's one guy who's like, if Barking and Dagenham Council doesn't listen to my road safety concerns this time, then blah, 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 blah. And so right away, you get the sense of this, I know Mark didn't like my Eye of Sauron, this attentional Eye of Sauron that is like, now let's all focus on Gaza. Well, let's focus on COVID. Let's focus on ivermectin. Let's focus on Ukraine. Let's focus on abortion. Let's focus on, you know, Jordan Peterson. You know, off we go, focusing on all of these things. Rod Dreher, I know how Rod Dreher finds this stuff. His audience finds it for him and sends it to him and then colonizes him, because the same thing happens with me. Shows then this University of Wisconsin campus that is including, one of their shouts is including glory to the murderers. And it's like, what is going on? Now part of this demonstrates the point that I've made about secularity being colonialist Jesus smuggling to the world, because what dominates the news feeds, and I was sort of, some local news was dealing with the conflict, and so then you hear Islamic Palestinian sources, and they basically sound like mid-20th century, they basically use arguments from mid-20th century mainline Christians, mostly not working, put together this great meme, which graphically puts together. So you have inside the Trojan horse, mid-20th century mainline Protestantism. The Trojan horse is the UN Declaration of Human Rights. Secular people just trotted in, and not just secular people, westernized people from all sorts of life sort of trotted in, and all under the supervision of modernity. Really, really great meme. Now, part of what's going on in this is the transformation of humanity through the traditional into the modern, now into the postmodern. And this is where we're going to get to our friend Hans Georg Müller, who I've done a number of videos before. Not too long. So his book, You and Your Profile, is currently, if you have an Audible, I don't know what level of subscription. I always have the 2 book a month subscription because I go through a lot of audiobooks. This, what Audible has been doing is sort of giving free books for a while. And so for, you don't actually keep them. It's sort of a cross between sort of Kindle Unlimited, where you have access to these books. But then if you unsubscribe, you lose access. So you get these books that you can listen to. And this is one of the books. That Hideous Strength was one of the books recently. But this is one of the books. And Kale listened to it. Kale Zeldin listened to it, and he sent me a message, said, you really gotta listen to this book, because this is right up your alley. And so started listening to the book, and, you know, Amazon and its ways to continue to relieve me of my money. Then I bought the Kindle book, and yeah, I think it's really a good book and a helpful book in terms of, and this is where sort of naming the spirits comes in, and where, so back in the 80s and 90s, you know, I was watching, participating with, you know, the whole charismatic movement of exorcism and spiritual oppression and spiritual warfare and all of that. And a lot of those groups put a lot of stock in sort of getting the name of the demon, getting the name of the spirit. And in many ways, with this, and I still haven't named it, with this way of spiritual warfare that I'm often talking about, which isn't exactly Frank Peretti spiritual warfare, getting a name on the spirit is a huge help. And so what he does is really get some names on some of these spirits, but and along the way, what he tends to do is start to rename spirits. And, well, let's talk about, let's see, which chapter am I in? Let's talk about these names. So the first word we want to talk about is sincerity. Now, again, for many of us, the word sincerity means sort of the opposite of lying. If I am sincere about an idea, it means there's a degree of integrity within me that is whole. And I'm not duplicitous on this. I am sincere about this. I really believe it. It might be right or wrong, but I really believe it and I live into it. Now for him, sincerity really gets into the pre-modern or the traditional. And the example that he uses is this photograph of a Chinese family from 1910. And he notes a number of things, including the foot binding. Sincerity is basically the application of traditional roles. Now, I'm going to add some ideas that aren't in his book, but basically you gain status in your community and are understood. Your identity gains status by fulfilling traditional roles. For the patriarch, for the father, your traditional role is to provide and to protect and to guide the rest of the family. For the mother, her traditional role is to protect and preserve and sustain the family. Male and female have separate roles. And of course, these roles are within a matrix of other roles. If you're a farmer, that's part of your sincerity. And so sincerity is the application of the role given to you, the role received to you that you must fulfill. And so if you're a peasant, you ought to be a great peasant. Now these ideas are, so this is basically the traditional world. Your identity is received, and the achievement is to fulfill, as best you can, the received identity, to play your part well. And on the basis of you play your part well, I can grab a biblical phrase, well done, good and faithful servant. With what you have been given, you have prospered. And so But basically, your identity is fixed and set by your sex, by your place of birth, by your lineage, by all of these things. Your identity is set, and sincerity is to fulfill them. Now, authenticity is a little different. Authenticity comes in the modern frame. Authenticity comes into the modern frame, and authenticity is sort of an identity that is, on one hand, ostensibly, it's derived by the will, but increasingly, because will and ego are suspect, how many people out there are talking about the destruction of the ego, the destruction of the ego? Then there's a need to find the basis, or at least the correspondence of authenticity with something else. Now, it can't be your received, sort of received from above. It can't be your received station in life, your sex, your lineage, your place. It has to come from a different source. And this is where the secret sacred self comes from. Way down deep below, there's this mythical secret sacred self that's my true self and my authentic self. And so in the era of expressive individualism, I gain status by expressing my secret sacred self in an authentic way. But the difficulty with authenticity is that performance and authenticity are very much in conflict with one another. And he opens the book with this nice little story. There is a small, almost hidden beach in Macau called Sha Kwan, or Bamboo Bay. Despite its immediate proxy to one of the most densely populated and heavily touristed areas in the world, the casinos draw tens of millions of visitors each year, nearly 5 miles 5 miles away. Bamboo Bay is a quiet place. Some older locals come daily to swim in the muddy, trash-filled ocean waters. On weekends, a few families, mostly Portuguese Macanese, spend some of their time, children playing in the sand as their parents may have done in their own youth in the old country. The few tourists who do not make their way to Bamboo Bay tend to be mainland Chinese or other East Asians, but they do not come to swim or sunbathe. They come to take pictures, pictures of themselves, posing in front of the shallow waves coming in. So we've got sincerity, which is sort of the traditional role. You gain status by fulfilling your traditional role. There's authenticity, whereby you gain status in this dance of expressing your authentic self, and your authentic self for many people is the secret, sacred self. And then you have profelicity, which is this other arena of sort of horcrux. Is there plural to horcrux? I'm just going to use horcrux as singular and plural. Horcrux that are hosted in the cyber world or in photographs or in other. See, that's why where horcrux are interesting, because in the cyber world, these horcrux are sort of completely mass producible. They come in to take pictures, pictures of themselves, posing in front of the shallow waves coming in, sitting on a rock, or walking along a beach with a long hair photogenically, with long hair photogenically blowing in the breeze. These beach goers do not stay long. They might stop to have a snack at a little cafe, but they quickly move on to other attractions. A European friend, having observed this scene, remarked both with amusement and critical disapproval that the tourists were not properly enjoying the scenery. Oh, there's an ought about what you ought to do to this place. There's lots of layers here. They were somehow oblivious to nature. So you've got some romanticism in here. To him, it seems, they were not even having fun, just staging a visit that, precisely because it consisted mainly of choreography, digital photographs, did not really take place, as Jean Baudrillard might have said. Nowadays, this kind of criticism is common, and the friend felt well justified, knowing many share his point of view. This is how we are justified. We are justified by the people. So the democratic way is in there. And again, you see these tensions in the Christian Reformed Church in terms of what ought the synod to do. But is our friend right? Perhaps he does not understand, being a middle-aged European, how tourism, along with all society, has changed, and how it is moving from an older bourgeois paradigm of authentic discovery to a new democratic one of profile-building exercise. The point of tourism today, in a world where all travel destinations are branded, marketed, and staged for visitors, cannot be to explore authentic localities. Tourism today, so there's an essentialism beneath authenticity. There has to be an essential Sacramento. But if you can see this for when, let's say, there's broader media coverage of the Sacramento Kings. So if the Sacramento Kings do well in basketball and are featured on TNT during the year, or perhaps make the playoffs and ABC comes to town, the ABC camera crews will go to the Tower Bridge. They'll look at the Ziggurat in West Sacramento. They'll look at the Capitol Building, and they'll look at the Golden One Arena. Because these things become then iconic, that's a really key word, to the essence of Sacramento. But now, this essence of Sacramento is within the arena of profelicity. The point of tourism today, in a world where all travel destinations are branded, marketed, and staged for visitors, cannot be to explore authentic localities. Livingstone's is an extremely authentic locality because, especially prior to, the authentic Livingstone's is prior to me having any degree of fame or stardom in this little corner or on the internet. Someone could say, I was at Livingstone's before Paul Vanderclay talked about Jordan Peterson. Oh, that's authentic. In fact, the most authentic Livingstoners don't even know any of you. And if you walk through the door on Sunday morning, you can see them, and you can see them being and doing their own thing, mostly untouched by the strange process of celebrity and tourism. Now, however, they've been tinged. Tourism today means taking part in a public performance, like going to a show, a parade, a protest, like going on a pilgrimage. Post-colonial world tourism no longer means primarily rich white people traveling to native places. Increasingly, it means people from previously colonized or formerly second or third world countries like Russia or China participating along with Westerners in a global traveling spectacle, a Guy Debord sense, displaying the simple fact that one can travel and that one has the time and money for it. I don't know if that's the essence of it, frankly. I think it's sensing the hierarchy that are in our world. Even though sort of we banish the stars and it's all about the secret, sacred self, the stars remain. Displaying the simple fact that one can travel, that one has the time and money for it and is granted a visa is already sufficient reason for doing it. I travel to take my trips part of my profile to actualize the profilic potential of tourism. It is a demonstration to myself and to others that I too am a traveler. It is my identity, but not just a traveler. Traveler is part of the wealthy class of people who, like me, with my American passport, am going to go to Europe and nobody's going to ask for a visa. Is that because of my whiteness? No, you can be black and go to Europe without a visa. They might look at you, still is racism, but probably not as much because, well, you might be African. You might be African American. And one of the things that you learn when you live in the third world or the developing world, however you want to call it, is that when I went to the Dominican Republic, I was abnormally wealthy and privileged for much of my environment, but I very quickly realized that there's this thin layer of Dominicans that have far more money than I ever will. And they travel far more around the world than I ever do. And they participate in sort of this world elite status, which really isn't marked out by race. You can find Nigerian oil barons. It's marked out much more by wealth. Saudis, old money, new money. And again, when Eric Weinstein in the video that I was that I made the other time talked about, you wouldn't believe the infrastructure that is available to this tiny slice of people. I'll have to take your word for it, buddy, because I've never seen it. But I don't doubt it at all. I mean, just even Jordan Peterson talking to Lex Fridman, talking about I fly private. Bill Maher has a great video on flying private, where he just sort of starts naming all of these very woke climate activists who fly private jets. And it's like, that's like your number one carbon footprint thing. You know how much fuel it takes to get that big, heavy airplane up in the air? I'm about to go on it too. Tourism today is a profile-building activity. Travel destinations, and almost every place in the world has become the travel destination by now, provides resources for profile-based identity or profilicity. That's where he introduces his term. Applied by the tourism industry, in tourism, concrete profile identity work consists in making and posting the photos. Taking and posting of images increased the profile value not only of the tourist but of the destination as well. All participants can experience the creation of value as enjoyable. Apparently, our middle-aged European friend did not yet understand the joy of tourism under conditions of profilicity. Now, for Mueller, profilicity is a super flexible word. Sometimes it's sort of an arena, sometimes it's a state of being, sometimes it's something we participate in, and so it's super flexible in this. Now, Algo served up for me a super interesting video from Kidology on lookism and lookmaxing. And I didn't know anything about any of this. I'm clearly not a lookmaxer, given the ongoing chaotic nature of my facial hair and the opinions shared on them on this channel. Let's listen to a little bit of Kidology here.
Worldwide, Tinder is the most popular dating app by a long shot. And what that means that by a long shot, the following information applies more and more so to more and more people. Because we are in an age where people are increasingly relying on social media to make those real life connections. And the information that I'm referring to is the fact that men have reported that they feel as if they receive far less messages then they send out. That is their report.
In other words, profilicity and status within the arena of profilicity has everything to do, again, with attention.
Not getting enough messages and are five times less likely than women to report so. And I suppose when we get into the nuance of things, this actually makes quite reasonable sense. The vast majority of Tinder users are men. Of the 75 million active monthly users, 75% of them are men. The gender imbalance on Tinder and on dating apps in general is something that needs to be spoken about more.
I would imagine if you're a woman, that's a good thing. It's a bad thing if you're a man who wants women.
Honestly, and I think more bluntly, it's quite clear from data that this gender imbalance is substantial. But when it comes to the emotions, the vulnerability, and the sensitivity of your average Joe trying to make it on Tinder, those sorts of things don't really apply to the individual and on the individual level. That is, nuance and rationality in this sense don't matter. And again, I have to say that this makes sense. The internet fixes on and sexualization, and this is especially so on social media platforms. The easiest way to make a quick buck is to appeal to the most base and most simple of human instincts.
Now, a part of profilicity, and this is what Mueller notes with this, sounds like kind of a crappy beach that is famous for just being famous, and go to Coney Island and check out the beach. Coney Island is basically on a beach. There's a boardwalk there, and you're really want to swim in Coney Island now, but you can, you know, and Grim Grizz might have some branding about it, and me just saying it might provoke someone in the Broken Clock Tower Discord to create branding from turn of the 19th to 20th century bathers on Coney Island. You know, I've got a that'll probably come in a next video, another article that someone on Voices sent me, which is really cool. This then creates value. And part of what is so potent about the pro-Felicity is that pro-Felicity has everything to do with money. You know, ever since Paris Hilton and Kim Kardashian, I mean, Kim Kardashian is the best example of becoming rich and famous for just first becoming famous for your pro-Felicity.
Thanks. The food industry tapped into this via sugar, and social media platforms are doing this by tapping into our basis of instincts via image-based content. Looks are everything, and with that, an increasing appreciation that attractiveness and your appearance can make or break your dating prospects. And all you need to do is scroll through Tinder or Instagram or any of its subsidiaries, and you get the picture. But I think that with this, we need to appreciate that our obsession with physical appearance has skyrocketed. And this is not just among women, but increasingly more so around men in the modern world. And I would say that this obsession around physicality, especially...
And of course it has, because we have moved from sincerity into this very fragile quest in authenticity, now into pro-Felicity, which gives us a metric. Because, well, I have so many subscribers on YouTube and so many followers on Twitter and so many friends in Facebook and so many, I don't know what they are, in Instagram. And these can be, I have clout. And so, you know, we watch the Bachelor or Bachelorette. Well, they're not here for the right reason. Well, what is the right reason? To find love. So the authenticity, to find the pairing, the pair bond, the soul mate of the secret sacred self. Oh no, they're here for clout. They're basically building a career on their image. And well, you know, we humans, I find it remarkable that she keeps talking about how she can't get dates. And it's like, you're a very attractive young woman who is very smart and very articulate. Is it something? Is it because on dates you're like you are in your videos? And I don't know why you can't get a date. It would seem to me you getting a date would be the easiest thing. But hey, what do I know? I've not dated for 37 years.
Among men online is not just to do with our hyperfixation on image and the physical appearance via, as I said, Instagram and Tinder, but also to do with men finding themselves in a very particular and unique historical context. In the same way that modern women do, and that we have more access to our own independence. And
now, of course, in sort of the tennis match of victimhood, this won't be mentioned, but yeah, this pro-Felicity in many ways advantages women, especially beautiful women, and men are struggling.
And to supporting ourselves, men find themselves in a rather precarious situation. There are no longer those historically clearly defined roles and positions within
sincerity.
Society or within the private sphere, which men very clearly had. Now we are all pretty equally, although in a different sense and in different ways.
Now equally, this is an achievement by modernity, because modernity is all about equality.
Confused and lost. We are lost and increasingly dissatisfied in navigating the harshness of the real world, as well as navigating the increasingly influential virtual world that is accessible to us with a mere touch of a screen. And this is another very important thing.
The world of pro-Felicity.
That I want to stress in this video. The internet makes it appear as if there are quick fixes to our problems, and also increasingly...
The internet and movies, and because if you got to wrap up your sitcom in 18 minutes and you have to wrap up your 1 hour TV show in 42 minutes and you have to wrap up your movie in 2 hours, quick fixes for everything.
As if there are solutions at our fingertips.
Remember what Jacob Howling said about solutions in politics? Well, yeah, that's pretty much true of life as well.
as if the world is quite literally at our fingertips. Through the internet and social media, we have access to unfettered desires that were previously either constrained or scarce. In crude terms,
we have access to certain degrees of satisfaction of desires that are likely going to be found in increasing measures less and less satisfying.
For a man to see a fully naked woman would take quite a lot of effort, time, and dedication. Even buying a magazine and hiding it from the rest of the household was a lot. And ultimately, it was still scarce because you had the same images in your collection. Now,
that was a great moment.
Type in four letters to your Google search bar and you're good to go. Adult content online.
I feel like such an innocent when I watch some of these things. Four letters. Oh, okay.
Racks in more annual revenue than Netflix, Twitter, and Hollywood combined. And this is really, literally a historical moment. For the first time in history, people other than the richest and most extravagant kings have unconstrained access from an increasingly younger age to their most outlandish sexual and personal desires. What previously could only be imagined and fantasized is now a click away and subsumed by profitable content galore. The effects of this in a general societal and data-intensive sense have not wholly been seen as of yet, but based on just anecdotal evidence and personal experience, I can say that you're seen as a sexual prude if you don't let a man strangle you or tie you up. But we...
Again, I feel so old when I listen to this because I think... I don't know.
Most definitely have not evolved socially or psychologically to deal with the exacerbated amounts of visual content that is put out to us daily. And this is especially relevant when it comes to our self-esteem and self-image. If you haven't heard of looks maxing, don't worry, neither had I until a few months ago.
I didn't. Now, this video is 10 months ago, so I'm really behind the times.
In short, I would say that it is a direct consequence and outcome of everything that I've outlined in the intro to this video. Because one thing that social media has most definitely contributed to and opened discussions around is the phenomenon of lookism. That is, prejudice or discrimination on the grounds of a person's physical appearance. And to be blunt, when it comes to average...
It's so amazing how we can create... how we can create these sins from something that is so completely instinctive.
Or below average looking people when it comes to conventional beauty standards. That is the majority of us mere mortals. Being inundated with not only exceptionally attractive individuals, but being told that we could potentially be those people with enough effort and the right information. It is no wonder that communities online are captivated by the language of maxing, especially when this is increasingly being marketed and promoted as the only viable way to get the life and success that you want, which you see, or your...
Now I could play that little bit from that sermon again about selling sunset, because this altruistic hedonism, I mean, this is the life that you want. And well, there it is in the screen, there it is in the stars. Now she's going to go through, and she's got quite a bit more of a global perspective than I. There's soft look maxing and hard maxing, which is sort of surgery. And of course, there's race involved here, there's sex involved here, there's all of these different things involved here. And of course, depending on and then she gets into the whole incel thing, which is fascinating. And then she gets into these look maxing. Now what's interesting is that, of course, the profilicity is going to have connection to the mass media. And now, again, the degree to which there's all this tension between the suspicion that it's arbitrary and the suspicion that it's fixed, it's biological, and then the cultural is in between. And that sort of dynamic is what is at the heart. In some ways, again, it's part of what's at the heart with Jordan Peterson's rise, because Jordan Peterson basically said, you know, there's structure to a lot of the things that have been sort of dismissed as social constructs. And so there's a spectrum there, and figuring out where these things are on the spectrum are important. But if you're looking at, you know, there's going to be winners and losers in this thing.
White men have it easier than men of color. Ethnocells are an intriguing phenomena. Please let me know in the comment section if you'd like me to make a separate video on this
alone. And
because I'm very interested in ethnocells. You have two options when cursed with the existence of being an ethnic. Live as an incel in the West, all the while getting berated by whites for being genetically inferior. Or live as a normie in your shithole of a homeland where famines, crime, civil war, riots, coup d'etats, poverty, political unrest, genocides, and diseases are rampant. Essentially, we have to choose our poison. And our honest...
And again, it was like, wow. On one hand, live as an incel in the West while all the while getting berated by whites for being genetically inferior. Where is that? And then you're talking about what places we see on the news. Now, again, there's profelicity in terms of all of these locations, too. Because it's so funny going to Europe, because when they hear about America, oh, it's a dangerous place. Oh, is it? Yeah, everybody has guns. Yeah, a lot of people have guns. Well, crime is higher in America. It is, I guess so. But I've tended to live in dangerous neighborhoods my whole life, and I haven't been a victim that often. And some of you may say, well, you're not a victim very often because you're 6'4", 240 pounds. Yeah, that has something to do with it. But then these dynamics, but on the other hand, these dynamics are totally believable.
They do see why it makes some ethnics so bitter. Another user says, also, I'm not coping. I've literally seen videos of girls saying, I don't want my kid to look like that. It's not Ma-Aryan. It's just, we don't want our kid to get uglier, and Asian and black is noticeably uglier. Race pull is...
Wow.
Strong. Just look at all the ethnic women seeking white sperm for their offsprings. You're more likely to come out attractive if you're born white, as they're better looking on average than the other races. On the other hand, if you're born ethnic, you have to surpass higher, insane odds to come out good looking. The chances of coming out subhuman are too great. The black pill is, if he got skin lightening, it would triple or quadruple the Freud's IOI. Not saying it's...
I remember when I first went to the Dominican Republic, I was doing some study of Trujillo, who was the dictator there in the 60s and 70s. Did he die in the 60s? I don't remember. But long before I got there. But, you know, Trujillo, there's always, the racism in the Dominican Republic was different than the racism in the United States, but it tended, again, to lean towards whiteness. Trujillo would lighten his skin. And if someone marries someone with lighter skin than themselves, they're bettering the race. Now, I saw versions of this racism between African Americans in Patterson, because one of the beauties about growing up as a kid in a different racial context is that people will say things in front of a kid that they won't say, people will say things in front of a white kid that they won't say in front of a white adult in terms of the racial dynamics.
Possible. Just be white applies in non-whites. Why do blacks obsess over a derogatory term for mixed race individuals? It's because they're light skin and have more white facial features that combine with some black features for a more aesthetic look in some cases. 90% of mixed race individuals actually look worse than full blacks, lol. There was another thread that I was on in which a young man was asked.
Now it's also interesting that part of what happens in this realm of profelicity, and I find this in myself, and I always resist it when I watch a video, it's like, then we get into the whole statistic games. How much of a sample does this represent? I mean, to what degree are we talking about people at the ends of the bell curve here? Now, these realities certainly exist, and I can see how in the broader culture there's sort of gravity that pulls in these directions. And that gravity has to do with racism and many other things. But, okay, so how much of that is there? So, and therefore, how much attention should I give it? Now, towards the end, she comes to this, what I thought was an incredibly interesting piece.
By our use and abuse of social media, as well as the presentation of get something quick schemes, get money quickly, hustle, as well as this hyperfixation on individual solutions to complex, all-encompassing, and interpersonal.
I'll just never listen to solutions again after Jacob Howland's comment on political solutions, because these are living things. There's no fixing them. And that's part of this profilicity question.
No problems. The depressing thing is that with these unrealistic expectations comes inevitable disappointment when those expectations are given more ground, more importance, and center stage over that of nuance and the very frightening experience of just taking a chance.
Well, it's also the age of decay. I will tell you, you can look great in your 20s. And in some ways, now that I'm, you know, over six, now that I've just started into my 60s, it's interesting how much better all these younger people look. And some of the things that sometimes people will say is, don't be afraid to take a picture. You're probably, all the pictures you take later on are going to look worse than they look now, because you'll just be older. You'll lose your hair. Trust me. It gets lost.
On something. I would also argue that the more time that we spend online and not in the real world means that our communicative skills really suffer.
Internet poisoning.
Just based on personal experience of going on dates, conversation has increasingly become a bit more superficial. And I think this...
I'm just blown away by the amount of sort of complaining. And maybe that's the point she was at 10 months ago or something, but I cannot imagine she has trouble getting dates, and I cannot imagine that she has trouble making conversation.
This is because online we are able to stay in communities that cater to our worldview, that cater to what we want to see and what we would nicely fashion into a world based on our rules, our regulations, the people and bodies that we want to see and engage with. The way we go onto social media and onto our subscription pages is very self-indulgent. And such self-indulgence really does not cater to us going.
And so what's interesting is that this, again, gets to my conversation with Guy Sengstock. You get this double bind where on one hand, it's self-indulgent and therefore debilitating. While we're complaining about the stress of it, it's sort of first world problems amped up.
Going into the world healthily. And this is especially the case for incels and for the likes of individuals who seemingly spend quite a bit of their time on looksmax.org. One incel described, for instance, his ideal woman, short stature.
This blew me away. And it's exactly iMUD, the original Star Trek episode.
But high E features, like relatively big lips, big titties, fat ass, quiet, doesn't ever contradict me, listens to me vent and tells me I'm right, which I am, gives amazing blowjobs, cooks, cleans up after me, not white, but light skinned, dark hair's fine, but she should diet a lighter color, pretty face because that matters more than anything, only dresses modestly out of the house, disparages men whom I dislike and also keeps away from my friends in order to appear as non-hypergamous as possible, because she knows that if I get even a whiff of a cheating, I will end her. Also, occasional threesomes with other women, and she lets me cheat, but just doesn't say anything because she knows I need to get my rocks off.
Buddy, you're in real trouble. And I don't mean real trouble and not being able to find this. Even if you were able to find it, you would continue to be in your own prison of pain. Rob Henderson had a really interesting tweet, which was highlighted for me by our marriage crisis squad. We have to do another video sometime again. The puppy thing is getting under control. So my son Jared said, another person on the Discord was lamenting how they couldn't get a rando slot. Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. The rando slots are coming back. I got this trip to Europe. There's always one thing or another getting in the way, but the puppy situation is getting under control. Things get better. Rob Henderson says, well, first he's responding to a tweet. The real black pill for men is not that women never move on from chat or whatever. It's that they actually endlessly pair bond because we have so much more oxytocin than they do. It's men who are run through after a single heartbreak. It's not that we never move on. It's that we can always move on. Women rise up. Men really have latched onto this whole pair bonding concept. They seem to think their penis is some kind of magic wand that women can't bear to part from. I can see why this fantasy is so popular among insecure men. And Rob Henderson said, there's something to this. Generally seems most women can get over exes fairly quickly and often wish they'd never been with them in the first place, whereas many men continue to carry a torch for a former romantic partner long after the breakup. Ian commented, it's a little overstated, but generally true, and then Rod sort of nicely packaged it up. There's definitely a truth here. Historically, women needing to adapt quickly to men dying, tribe being conquered, etc., but I've seen both sides of this. Later in life, this flicks as the single divorced woman scrolling through their remarried ex's social media. I don't know if that's sort of, that's an interesting dynamic. The old saw that women control access to sex and men control access to commitment. Yeah, that's right. That's right. So we see ourselves both in the social and the big picture, because of course, why do children and universities, why do they line up in order to express what the type of statement that they should lose status with, and why do they do it on social media? Because again, the media is this arena and it's this horcrux, and they now in some ways try to fix their identity and make their identity mobile within a ladder to gain status in order to pursue and achieve some kind of ideal. So, and this whole lookism, again, is about climbing this ladder, about seeking identity. It's about pursuing the ideal and, well, trying to achieve it. But if your ideal is a bad one, as with this, then that's a really sad case, because you're trying to climb a ladder and there's no there. There's only more misery and heartbreak. If you want to improve a society, give them better ideals. And then, well, the ideals right now, sincerity, they tended to be in the religious environment. Authenticity, incredibly fragile, but of course, for many, the secret sacred self was a product of some post-sincerity, but a fair amount of sincerity existed. Now with profelicity, well, my text this week, and it usually comes back down to my text, Colossians 3:4, well, we can go, the sermon is still in production. You'll see it in the Friday or the Saturday morning rough draft for Sunday. Since then, you have been raised with Christ. Set your hearts on things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on earthly things, for you have died and your life is now hidden with Christ in God. In a sense, Christ, he's not a horcrux, of course, but Christ is the location of your identity as a Christian. And it's something fixed. Now, notice that in sort of modern materialism, new atheism, well, your identity is this meat sack. I mean, that just falls apart so quickly, because we don't act like our identity is the meat sack. And then 3:4 says, when Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory. So your identity is fixed. Now you can see with sincerity, it's something received, but very quickly Christians saw this sincerity-based identity as being transcended in Christ. It's part of why slaves, people who have short, hard lives, they grabbed onto Christ. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will appear with him in glory. And now this is both in Christ sort of a participation, but it's also, then we will appear with him in glory, because the image is that Christ comes from heaven to earth, bringing his kingdom and his saints with him. And that's the whole idea of meeting him up in the air. And N.T. Wright talks about that nicely in one of his books. But this is, so with Christianity, you can see where all of this is sort of downstream from Christianity, because there's the moving off of this just received identity. And it's not authenticity, because there isn't a secret sacred self. Your life, who Christ, who is your life, appears, then you will appear with him in glory. And it's not prophelicity. It's not just an arena of screens. It's this foundational spiritual arena. So that's that. I didn't produce it yesterday to get it out in time for homeroom. Maybe I'll publish it now, and we'll see where this goes. So leave a comment. Let me know what you think.